Andrew Roberts, again, is someone who's coming to digital poetry from a literary background that's more focused on modernism. He wrote a book on Conrad and masculinity, on Jeffrey Hill, and on poetry and contemporary culture. He's writing about, there's a book coming out on poetry and ethics. But he has leapt into the study of digital poetry and is currently directing an AHRC poetry beyond text project, which is looking at both digital poetry but also visual poetry and sort of other interactions of poetry and image. So be hearing about that.
Thanks very much, Scott, and I'm very grateful to Scott for inviting me to come and talk about the Beyond Text project, which in some ways is a very different sort of project but has some connections which I hope will be interesting. It's only part of it is concerned with electronic literature, and because in some ways that's the most complicated part to deal with, that's what we're coming to at the end of the project. So in giving the overview of the project, I'll tell you a bit about some of the things we've been doing already, and the section of it that relates to digital literature or electronic literature specifically will in some ways be a discussion of kind of question and issues that we want to raise rather than providing answers. So the Poetry Beyond Text project, the subtitle of it is Image, Text and Cognition, and it's part of the a large program by the Arts and Humanities Funding Council in the UK, which is called the Beyond Text Programme, which was a theme that they came up with. And it was a very broad theme because the concept of the beyond, what it means to be beyond text, was very open, and it's been interpreted in a lot of different ways. And quite a few of the 40 projects that are funded...
Excuse me. It's not,
you had a it's not coming up. All right. Sorry, we're not getting the picture yet. What would you
have to go into the desktop settings?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Just right click on your desktop.
On the.
It's anywhere on the desktop. Uh-huh. Just right click. Graphical options. Or display modes, maybe.
Good, we're there. So quite a lot of the projects interpreted beyond text as meaning not text. So there are projects which are to do with sound, to do with playground songs, to do with music in communities. There's one on Black British jazz. We interpreted beyond text as meaning text, but also something as well as text. So the sort of work that we're looking at is something that we defined loosely as a hybrid work, including text and elements of the visual. Now, that in itself is obviously fairly open because you can combine text with images, which in one way is obviously visual, but text, as nobody here I think needs reminding, has its own visuality. So just for examples of the sort of works that we're studying, concrete poetry, example from the Scottish poet Ian Hamilton Finlay, and a famous one by Gomringer, Silencio. We're also looking at digital poetry and electronic literature, which again probably needs no introduction to most people here. But I'll come back to that later on. We're also looking at artists' books because the materiality of the text or the object is another focus of the project, and artists' books in many ways foreground the materiality of the text. And we're also looking at combinations of photos and poems, which is a minority or small but interesting genre of various sorts. So, for example, we were comparing this book by the poet Tom Gunn and his brothers Anders, which has a fairly kind of representational or literal relationship between poems and photographs, and this book by the poet Paul Muldoon with a photographer, where the relationship between the two is much less obvious and more surrealist. So the project is being carried out by a team of seven people from English comparative literature, fine art and psychology. And we're using psychological, critical and creative methods to study how readers respond to the visual aspects of poetry and also how poets and artists respond to the possibilities which arise between and across text and image. And the methods we're using include some which are central to the humanities tradition, such as close analysis of text and the application of theoretical, historical, and philosophical concepts. But they also include methods from human experimental psychology, such as eye tracking, the measuring of bodily movements, MRI scanning. And then there are methodological areas where the two disciplines overlap or appear to overlap, but tend to come at it with very different assumptions, particularly various forms of feedback and response from what we call our co-researchers, who are mostly undergraduates and postgraduates, as well as from poets and artists, so things like questionnaires, written responses, interviews, performed and verbalized responses. And then there's another whole area of method which is drawn from creative practice and practice-based research and fine art, particularly the commissioning of new works of art as part of the research process and accounts of the collaborative and creative process. Inter- or multidisciplinarity of this sort, I think, is always a matter of negotiation, involving at best creative tension, and at other times involving defensive and offensive tactics in which disciplines appropriate or defend their intellectual territory. And this is interesting in relation to psychology. I think it touches a bit on some of the issues that Ira was mentioning, because there's a degree of radical incommensurability between how experimental psychologists would look at reading a poem and how a literary critic would. But this is something that I quite enjoy, because the theorization of these sorts of differences in itself is quite productive and tends to revolve around questions of repeatability, questions of value, questions of models of communication. So in describing what results from this project, I like to refer to Adorno's concept of a Kraftfeld or force field, partly because referring to Adorno always makes you sound profound, but more seriously, I just think it describes it nicely, which has been summarized as a relational interplay of attractions and aversions that constitute the dynamic transmutational structure of a complex phenomenon. And I like that because literary studies and experimental psychology, I think, both attract and repel each other, and the experience of collaboration often produces a series of epiphanies and aporias which alternate with each other. And I think in a more subtle way, the same can be true of collaboration between literary criticism and practice-based research, which obviously have much more in common, and the terms of potential disagreement are much less stark, but they nevertheless are quite important differences in how research is framed. And in many ways, I think it's precisely the incommensurability of the different disciplines that I find interesting. So rather than trying to kind of unite them into some harmonious whole, I'm interested in what emerges from the dialogue between them. So one or two examples of what we're doing. One psychological method I mentioned was eye tracking. And research in psychology claims to have established a connection between eye movements and the cognitive processes involved in reading, although reading here has to be defined as linguistic competence rather than in the full sense of interpretation. And eye tracking is based on the eye-mind assumption that the location of the eye fixation indicates the content of cognitive operations, and the immediacy assumption that the duration of that fixation reflects the extent of cognitive processing of that particular word. So just a quick example of an experiment we did. This was on the poem Pythagorean Silence by the American poet Susan Howe. And we used three pages from this long sequence. And this is the first one. I don't really have time to sort of talk about its place in the sequence as a whole, but this, as you can see, is a more or less lineated page, though with some gaps. And it's then followed by this page, which is two lines, or are they in fact lines? And then it's followed by this page, which is a characteristic Howe dispersed page. Marjorie Perloff describes Howe's work as part of a poetics of non-linearity or post-linearity. And this work does seem to move beyond free verse. So the participants read the first two poems, first read two poems which were relatively linear in form, and then they read these three pages in sequence. Now, some critics interpret Howe's use of space in political terms as a trope for an anti-authoritarian practice, but I was particularly interested in a statement by the American critic Jerome McGann, who interprets in more perceptual and aesthetic terms. And basically what he says is when you go from the second of those pages to the third one, the top-down left-right sequence of normal reading is displaced. And he describes how you look at this page as being like how you look at the night sky. He says, we gaze at it much as one gazes at a night sky, no longer being told where to begin or where to go. The law of the margin and the law of headers are both called to judgment when we turn to the verse, along with that other great seriality of language, syntax. And I thought this was interesting generally in relation to the visuality of poetry, and this has obvious kind of analogues and extensions in relation to electronic poetry. So I just need to drop out of PowerPoint for a minute. And I'll show you an example of somebody reading that page. And Howe, H-O-W-E, sorry, Susan Howe. And what's interesting, I think, here is the effect of the two words ceremony in the middle of the page, which look as if they're almost overlapping. They're actually just about touching. Starts at the beginning for some reason. I'll just stop that and start at the beginning. So what this reader does, which is interesting, is they start at the top and start reading in a relatively normal way, although they're a bit affected by the slope from the W to Whortleberries to Unhired. But then when they get to the two ceremonies in the middle, that actually seems to transform the reading process. So this is in real time. So pretty much left to right here, and then whoop, you get to ceremony and suddenly it goes all over the place. And she returns a lot to those words ceremony throughout the reading. And she does. He's a very careful reader, this one. He made very interesting comments on the poem. And she makes several readings through, but repeatedly, when she gets to ceremony, that changes the process of her reading. Mm-hmm. So there is a way in which this seems to, in some ways, validate elements of Howe's strategy, because the centrality of that ceremony as defining a pattern rather than a linear text seems to be validated by this. To an extent, it supports McGann's claim of a shift from reading to scanning, although I'm not saying that you can kind of test those sort of critical claims empirically, because literary statements are obviously partly normative rather than descriptive, and there are many complicating factors like literary competence and individual difference. But McGann puts a lot of emphasis on the materiality of reading and the literalness of his statement. So I think heuristically it's quite interesting to take it literally, to interrogate it, to say, is he actually talking about a literal process of reading, or is he talking about some ideal process which exists in a kind of critical or theoretical realm which is then realised through readings which may not be like that at all. So that's a heat map of the first part of the reading showing the concentration on the word ceremony. Another thing we've been doing is, this was something which was devised by Mary Modine, who's my collaborator in fine art, who is a printmaker, and I was particularly interested in ideas about visual thinking, which I think are talked about a lot, but often not very well defined. I read a strange article by Douglas Copeland where he asserted absolutely unequivocally that the people who think visually, and they're a whole different class of people, in its own his only definition of them was that they used Apple Macs rather than PCs, which didn't seem to me kind of entirely rigorous definition. And there's a lot of debate about this in relation to education as well. But what she did was staged a series of, if you like, translations between poems and visual works. So we started off with Wallace Stevens' The Jar, and also with this poem by a Scottish concrete poet, he doesn't only do concrete, called Jim Carruth, who's a former farmer and writes a lot about farming and the economics and sociology of farming. So it's quite a nice, relatively simple little concrete poem. And she asked art students to produce visual works or material works, works in any genre, in response to these poems, but without articulating verbally what they were doing and without including words in the work. And this was one example of a work that was produced in response to that Carruth poem, which is graphite, this work, and it's scored by a turntable stylus, and then it's partially restitched with a photographic layer underneath. There's a series of translations of that sort taking place. So the stages of the project, experimental and theoretical, have been ordered thematically and divided between the two parts of the team in Dundee and Kent. So the themes have been materiality, space, ambiguity, interactivity, and time. And the outputs include an online gallery and website and exhibitions initially at Dundee Contemporary Arts and then at the Royal Scottish Academy, and also some more conventional academic outputs in the sense of articles. How am I doing for time, Scott? Pretty not much time. 2 minutes, 3 minutes, what would be? Yeah. So this is the bit where I talk about electronic literature, so I've handily left myself only 2 minutes to do it, which I think is maybe a wise decision. But I just wanted really to sketch in some of the things we're interested in here. One thing we're interested is a sort of convergence between digital or electronic literature and experimental method. And this, I think, is not the same as the general phenomenon of digital convergence, and it's not quite the same as Henry Jenkins' concept of convergent culture across media, although it may be connected to those. I think what it is a convergence in certain interests and methods between the creators of electronic literature and researchers in academic Human Experimental Psychology. One example which has been discussed a little bit by Catherine Hales and others is Younghae Chan Heavy Industries, who I'm sure many of you will be familiar with their work, but they typically use flash to present a series of phrases or words. And critics such as Jessica Pressman have sometimes suggested that the speed of this work makes it very difficult to read, and she uses that as a justification for linking it to modernism. But it has quite a similarity to rapid serial visual presentation, which is a standard psychological technique, and research in that shows actually that this sort of presentation, where you don't have to make eye movements because the words appear in succession on the screen, or don't have to make so many, actually speeds up reading. Some people claim that you can read about 50 words a second by this method, which I think is hugely exaggerated, but there's no doubt you can read faster by that method. The other example I wanted to mention is a more contemporary one. One of the things we're doing in the project is commissioning works, and Simon Biggs, who's with us today, is creating a work for us in collaboration with a computer programmer and psychologist at Abertay University, where they have what they call the Hive, which is a total immersion video environment for interaction with virtual environments. So it's a 3D video simulator, basically. I won't go into that work a lot for reasons of time, and it's still a work in progress. But it's a work which uses a corpus of language, and where the participant speaks to the work, and the work then tries to anticipate what they're going to say and visually represents back to them both what they might be going to say and what they might do say. So it draws on Simon's existing work in that area, but develops it in the context of this 3D simulation environment. And I thought that was interesting in terms of the phenomenon of convergence, because one of the things that struck me as a sort of observer of that collaborative process, and Simon may or may not want to sort of comment on this, is that Simon was from an art college and creative practice background, although he's obviously relatively skilled in programming, and the programmer was from a psychological background, and he had so far used this Hive. It had been used basically for visualizing complex scientific data and for things like developing gaming and for training police marksmen. So it had been used largely for utilitarian purposes, and yet it seemed to me that in many ways Simon and Mark, who was the programmer, were talking the same language, and although many of the same issues were coming up in relation to using this this facility for a creative purpose, as had come up in using it for kind of visualizing electronic data. And I don't just mean the same issues at the level of basic programming and functioning, but in a wider sense than that. So we're interested in what this sort of convergence might mean for the categories of the aesthetic or the categories of literature and the artwork. Because I think it raises interesting questions in relation to both the creative practice and to the approaches taken by the psychologists. And in both fields, there's a certain challenge there. The other area that we're interested in looking at is the whole kind of vexed question of interactivity. And I think I won't start on that now for reasons of time. So I'll just end with the address for the project website. At the moment, it's got material about the project on. The gallery is empty at the moment because the works that are going to go on there are still being commissioned. And I'll stop there. Thank you.